Buckminster Fuller coined the phrase spaceship Earth to describe the oneness of our planet as well as our common destiny. Reverend Michael McGee said Fuller wanted that image of an Earth with no national boundaries, no enemies and allies, no victors and vanquished, to sink into our consciousness. But the Earth is not a spaceship. It's a living, breathing being. The poetic biologist Lewis Thomas describes the view of the Earth from the moon. Viewed from the distance of the moon, the astonishing thing about the Earth catching the breath is that it's alive. The photographs show the dry, pounded surface of the moon in the foreground, dead as an old bone, aloft, floating free beneath the moist, gleaming membrane of a bright blue sky. Is the rising Earth, the only exuberant thing in this part of the cosmos. If you could look long enough, you would see the swirling of the great drifts of the white clouds, covering and uncovering the half-hidden masses of land. If you had been looking for a very long geologic time, you could have seen the continents themselves in motion, drifting apart on their crustal plates, held afloat by the fire beneath. It has the organized, self-contained look of a live creature, full of information, marvelously skilled in handling the sun. Now, whether you see the Earth from far out in space, or in the magnificence of a forest, or a tree, or one leaf, you can see that it's obvious that this planet lives. Once we begin to see the Earth as a living, breathing being, and every entity is part of this being, then it changes the way we think and feel and relate. We begin to realize that the planet is not only alive, but it is infused with spirit. Have you ever thought about it? That if we lived on the moon, our imagination and intelligence would be as void as the moon's atmosphere and landscape? But because we are creations of Gaia, Earth, a planet lush, diverse, colorful, and saturated with myriad sights and sounds, we have a consciousness that is rich with creativity and fertile with vision and insight. We need a communion with our world as much as we need food. Humanity itself is a theoretical concept, not a reality. Cut a child off from the stimulation of the Earth, and that child's intelligence, emotional stability, and creativity will diminish and eventually vanish, leaving the child only a shell of a human being. We exist only in relationship with the Earth and the sky, the trees and the insects, with Gaia. We need a beautiful world to have a full consciousness and to be healed and whole. If our environment collapses, so do we. And it is evident that our environment is collapsing. Sadly, our past government was doing little to help preserve our planet's resources and future. In fact, in the first 100 days of the Bush environment, it had virtually declared war on our planet's environment. To celebrate Earth Day, the House of Representatives in 2005 approved a new energy bill that included drilling for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, or what is called by some the American Serengeti. Our government hasn't always been so lackadaisical. We celebrate Earth Day. In the United States, Earth Day is celebrated by most people on April 22nd. But there is another celebration that predates that one by approximately a month, and is celebrated internationally. The first Earth Day celebration took place on March 21st, 1970, on the vernal equinox of that year. It was the brainchild of John McConnell, a newspaper publisher and influential community activist who proposed the idea of a global holiday called Earth Day at a UNESCO conference on the environment in 1969. McConnell suggested an annual observance to remind the people of Earth of their shared responsibility as environmental stewards. He chose the vernal equinox, always March 20th or 21st. He said, "This is nature's day when light and darkness, day and night, are of equal length worldwide." McConnell believed that Earth Day should be a time of equilibrium, when people could put aside their differences and recognize their common need to preserve Earth's resources. On February 26, 1971, UN Secretary General U Thant signed a proclamation saying that United Nations would celebrate Earth Day annually on the vernal equinox, thereby officially establishing the March date as the International Earth Day. In his Earth Day statement on March 21, 1971, U Thant said, "May there only be peaceful and cheerful Earth Days to come for our beautiful spaceship Earth as it continues to spin and circle in frigid space, with its warm and fragile cargo of animate life." The United Nations continues to celebrate Earth Day each year by ringing the peace bell at UN headquarters in New York City at the precise moment of the vernal equinox. This year, in 2009, the peace bell was rung by Pete Seeger. In America, the environmental movement, most agree, started in 1962 with the publication of Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring. Carson's examination of pesticides, particularly DDT, had far-reaching implications for all technologies. In November of 1962, former Senator Gaylord Nelson took up the cause. He persuaded President John Kennedy to go on a 5-day, 11-state national tour to give visibility to the environmental conservation cause. Kennedy began his tour in September of 1963. For many reasons, the tour did not succeed in putting the issue onto the political agenda. However, it was the germ of the idea that ultimately flowered into a National Earth Day that was held on April 22, 1970. The environmental teach-in, held as a nationwide day of environmental education and activism. The event was wildly successful, sparking Earth Day celebrations at thousands of colleges, universities, schools, and communities across the nation. Following the Earth Day celebration inspired by Nelson, which demonstrated widespread grassroots support for the environmental legislation, Congress passed many important environmental laws, including the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, as well as many laws to protect wilderness areas. The Environmental Protection Agency was created within 3 years after Earth Day 1970. Earth Day raises awareness of environmental issues and promotes environmental action. Reverend Frank Hall says that Earth Day is also about the human environment, the inner life that directs us. It's about becoming more conscious of the way we live, and conscious living in the heart of one's religious or spiritual life. Since that first Earth Day celebration, there's been a weaving of our increased concern about the damage we've been doing to the earth and one's religious life. Most of the religions across the wide spectrum are uniting on this point. What we think about the earth and the way we behave toward the earth is at the heart of religion. Earth Day is not intended to make us feel guilty. It's not about shaming. It's about raising awareness about the effect our lifestyle has on our planet, our home. Increased awareness sometimes results in feeling uncomfortable. It gets our attention. We know we're all a part of the problem, but hope is that raising our awareness can help us to think about how to become part of the solution, how to participate in the greening of the planet. Reverend Hall says that just as the rivers and oceans can become polluted, so can our minds become polluted. Concerns about global warming have been getting politicized with red state and blue state opinions about what's causing climatic changes and who's responsible for the problem and who should be responsible for making the necessary changes to prevent global tragedy. During the Bush administration, we became acutely aware of those earlier important environmental acts and laws and that they were being tinkered with and had holes poked in them. Now we, the people, need not only knowledge, but wisdom, and we need to know the difference. The Reverend Dr. William Schultz, past executive director of Amnesty International USA and former president of Unitarian Universalist Association, explains our commitment in these words. Hundreds of years ago, St. Lawrence asked, "Whom should I adore, the Creator or the creation?" Most Western religions have answered back, "Adore the Creator," and have supplied images of Zeus, Jehovah, Christ, to be adored. But our answer is far different. Adore the creation, surely, for whatever there is of the Creator will be made manifest in her handiwork. God, said Mies van der Rohe, dwells in the details. The divine for us, whatever its essence be, is not confined to the transcendent realm, its ramparts guarded by the scholarly elite. On the contrary, the holy is made manifest to every one of us, not just those who can recite the catechism in the transactions of the everyday. And this in turn is why we love the earth, honor the human body, and bless the stars. Religion is not just a matter of things unseen. For us, the holy is not hidden, but shows its face in the blush of the world's exuberance. Our faith is one of action. We are at its best when we stand together, as this fellowship has done since I was a child. We have stood against war, stood up for many human rights, and for some, stood against the death penalty. Unitarianism means unity, and that's what Unitarian Universalism stands for. Unity is the message of our principles. Reverend Michael McGee points out, it has been said that only the first and last of our seven principles are actually principles, and that the others are ways in which we bring about those two essential values that go to the heart of our faith. How appropriate that the first principle, we covenant to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person, no matter the race, religion, nation, or sexual orientation, we are all one, deals with our relationship with ourselves and each other. And the seventh principle, we covenant to affirm and promote respect for the interdependent web of all existence, deals with our relationship with the earth. This is the axis our lives revolve around, humanity and nature. To be close to nature is not easy for anyone who lives in this culture. Our society has built huge barriers between ourselves and the earth, barriers to protect us from its dangers. But that has also cut us off from the sustaining spirit of this bountiful planet. We can see our alienation in more personal ways too. Take, for instance, the supposedly actual comments left on Forest Service registration sheets and comment cards. Too many bugs and spiders and spider webs. Please spray the wilderness to rid the area of these pests. Please avoid building trails that go uphill. The coyotes made too much noise last night and kept me awake. Please eradicate the area of these pests. A McDonald's would be nice at the trailhead. Too many rocks in the mountains. Have we forgotten that nature comes as is? What about our stewards, the National Park Service, the Forest Service, and the Bureau of Land Management, which during the Bush administration received a black eye? They are to preserve and protect. We are merely visitors when we go camping and hiking on the land, and especially while we're in the wilderness, which is to be kept as pristine as humanly possible. Take only pictures, leave only footprints. If you pack it in, you pack it out, including feces. When we head to the outdoors, we leave behind many of the commodities that make life easy. Although REI has come up with many numerous can't-live-without products that make life camping a whole different experience now than it was 15 or more years ago. Hiking or going for a walk, getting out in the woods or desert or fields, make an experience to experience. Can we find a balance? One of global living and us making peace with the environment? The following is from a small book by Ursula Goodenough, The Sacred Depths of Nature. I walk through the Missouri woods, and the organisms are everywhere, seen and unseen, flying about or pushing through the soil or rummaging under leaves, adapting and reproducing. I open my senses to them and we connect. I no longer need to anthropomorphize them, to value them because they are beautiful or amusing or important for my survival. I see them as they are. I understand how they work. I think about their genes switching on and off, their cells dividing and differentiating in pace with my own, homologous with my own. I take in the sycamore by the river, and I think about its story, the ancient algae and mosses and ferns that came before, the tiny progenitor that gave rise to it and to me. I try to guess why it looks the way it does, why the leaves are so serrated and the bark so white. And imagine all sorts of answers, all manner of selections and unintended consequences that have yielded this tree to existence and hence to my experience. We work at trying to balance saving the environment with just trying to make it through our daily responsibilities. Despair and apathy are common attitudes. Those who grew up in a time when activism saw results can't understand why it's so much harder now. There's a story about an old Cherokee who one evening told his grandson about a battle that goes on inside people. He said, "My son, the battle is between two wolves inside us all. The one wolf is evil. It is anger, envy, sorrow, regret, greed, arrogance, superiority, self-pity, guilt, resentment, inferiority, lies, false pride, and ego. The other wolf is good. It is joy, peace, love, hope, serenity, humility, kindness, benevolence, empathy, generosity, truth, compassion, and faith. The grandson thought about it for a few minutes and then asked, "Which wolf wins?" The old Cherokee simply replied, "The one that you feed." The Unitarians have been making connections with other people, with ourselves, with our religion, and with the earth. We have worked at becoming and being good stewards. Back in 1989, Unitarian Universalists voted at our General Assembly a resolution titled "Protecting Our Biosphere." That was followed by several others: Safer Sources of Energy in 92, Population and Development in 96, Earth, Air, Water, and Fire in 97. In 2001, we voted "Responsible Consumption is Our Moral Imperative." And in 2006, we addressed the threat of global warming. A suggested question for covenant groups to discuss and for everyone else to contemplate as well is, in what ways do you weave the interdependent web of life? How do you feel connected to the earth and nurture that bond? Let me end with this simple story of an old man who was so wise he could answer questions that were almost impossible for people to answer. So two young people decided to go to him one day. They said to one another, "We're going to trick the old man today. We're going to catch a bird, and we're going to take it to the old man, and we're going to say to him, 'This that we hold in our hands today, is it alive or is it dead? And if he says dead, we're going to open our hands and let the bird fly free. But if he says alive, then we're going to crush it.'" So the two young people went to the old man and they said, "This that we hold in our hands today, is it alive or is it dead?" The old man looked at the young people and he smiled and he said, "It's in your hands. The future of the earth, aloft, floating free beneath the moist membranes of the bright blue sky, the only exuberant thing in this part of the cosmos, and of our children. The future is now in our hands. May we handle it with exceedingly loving care. May it be so."